name's Vanya. This is Stas, JT, and Mark, and we're waiting for Wayne, and we're all sort of involved with the organizing with NEFAC, and we're going to touch upon that a little bit today, but try to do more like broad history of anarchist organizing involving the federations. So, and then talk about our like the vision and strategy that we're trying to put forth in the NEFAC Federation. So that's it, and Jessica is going to facilitate. Can you say a few things?
Yeah, I was going to kind of explain like the order we're going to talk about things. First, there's going to be a short presentation about remark about Federation history, NEFAC history, and some strategy. Wayne, when he gets here, is going to do Love and Rage. And we're hoping that this will give you guys like a basic overview of some different types of federations and whether or not that can work for your collectives. And then questions, answers, discussion, and stuff. And the way I facilitate is if like a lot of hands start coming up, I'm going to start taking stack. And unless you indicate to me somehow that you want to direct response to a person, I'm just going to go in the order that people raise their hands.
I guess I get to do the exciting history. Just start off, I'm a horrible public speaker, and I'm still waking up, so just bear with me.
We are.
But, my name's Mark. I'm from Sabbate Anarchist Collective in Boston. One of the founding members in EFAC. I guess currently we have about 60 to 80 members, which sadly enough makes us probably the largest anarchist organization in North America. Federations sort of have a long history, and it goes hand in hand sort of with anarcho-communism as a tradition. I don't know if anybody's brushed up on their history, but I mean, it goes back to Bakunin, and he was organizing in Italy. A lot of the anarchists organizing around him, Malatesta, Carlo Caffira, Andrea Costa, they all, sort of followed Bakunin to a point, but then were critical of a number of his ideas, specifically around, workers' ownership, collectives, maintaining a market system, things like this. So, I mean, they put forward an idea of communism where market system's abolished. There's no worker ownership. It's, common ownership. It's, So those are the basic ideas. Kropotkin, of course, elaborated on that, and wrote extensive works on it. He organized within the Jura Federation, which was a Swiss, kind of the remnants of the First International, the anarchist branch of it. They adopted a policy of anarcho-communism early on. That went on to founding the Black International, which, in addition to popularizing propaganda by the deed, also pushed forward anarcho-communism, which was brought to the U.S. by Johann Most. Haymarket martyrs were all part of the Black International. It has its ties in U.S. anarchist history as well. The Makhnovists in Russia, they organized like large expanses of Russia and anarcho-communist principles. Florence Magón and the Mexican Liberal Party and the Mexican Revolution, Japan, China, Korea all had large anarcho-communist federations. Syndicalism never really took root in those countries. Even within the CNT, like towards the end, the FAI, groups like Tierra Libertad and theorists like Isaac Puente began to formulate a libertarian communist perspective for their organizing. So there's like, it's kind of a lot of lost history. A lot of people ask us why we organize as communists. And, there's sort of a tradition to draw on. I think there's a lot from the broader anarchist tradition to find inspiration in. But as far as like organizing around a like coherent body of ideas and tradition, I guess I sort of agree with Book Two when he says that you sort of have to be a little more specific than just calling yourself an anarchist, because that that carries a lot of baggage. And so for us, the idea was sort of organizing within the social anarchist tradition, but not limiting ourselves to syndicalism, which to us is a strategy and a valid strategy, but it's not an ideology that, I mean, I don't want to see workers run things. I want to see everybody, you know, empowered communities and the workplace and, you know, in all areas of life. So I think, to me, anarcho-communism is a valid means of organizing. I think as a strategy we can incorporate like a revolutionary pluralism, which means that you organize, you know, on many fronts. And class struggle for us isn't limited to the workplace. I mean, it's, you know, it's in housing, it's in communities. So for us, a lot of our strategy is trying to, I guess, just find these areas of struggle and how we can radicalize them and, you know, et cetera, which is why we don't just all join the IWW, because that to us is a limited strategy. I guess more recently, in the last 20 years, there's groups like the, actually in North America, there's a North American Anarchist Communist Federation, which we got a lot of their documents when we were putting our group together to sort of study. I think they sort of came out of the 60s and were not happy with how anarchism was going, so they kind of opted for this more structured model. I think they ran from like 77 to 83. And they put out a newspaper and some good stuff and whatever. They're all syndicalists now, but at the time they had some good stuff. And then in Europe, there's the British ACF, or the AF now, the Workers' Solidarity Movement. And Italy, there's the FDCA, basically Anarcho-Communist Federation. And there's a lot of groups now currently organizing under the Anarchist-Communist label, sort of platformist groups as well, which is also a sort of strain of thought that we take inspiration from. I don't know if people are familiar with, I mean, the original, the organizational platform of libertarian communists, which is sort of a critical piece of writing that came out after the Russian Revolution and the defeat of the Makhnovists. And personally, like, I think there's a lot to be learned from it, especially in terms of, like, tactical and theoretical unity and accountability and federalism. But I also critical of a lot of parts of it, especially, like, its sort of militaristic language and sections and, you know, the idea of trying to organize all anarchists, you know, behind one banner, I don't think is a good option, you know, good way to go. But as far as groups that consciously want to organize themselves, I think it does provide a good model if used critically. And a lot of these groups also sort of organize around those principles. And which sort of brings us to NEFAC, which I guess we'd go back to about the time Love and Rage dissolved in 1998, which was also this class war dissolved in Britain. It was sort of like, you know, everything that was built up in the 90s was sort of coming to an end at that point, and there was sort of a rebirth of anarchism, especially in this country. And the British ACF actually put out a call to form a, I don't know, they had this ambitious idea of a global anarchist communist federation or something. So the newspaper I was working on, We Dare Be Free, we sort of answered their call, and, you know, we networked with some people that they put us in touch with, specifically a group called Raise the Walls in Atlanta, which I think is gone now. Nothing really came of that, but they did write about our efforts in their magazine in a sort of critical article on Americans. I think it was called Quiet Americans, and sort of critical of the way the movement was going here and how there wasn't much coherence. And but they also wrote about some groups from Quebec sort of doing the same thing. I mean, we were organizing predominantly in New England, and in Quebec they were trying to do a federation as well. So we, you know, just put two and two together and made contact with each other. This group, kind of the remnants of Domanishi, which was a group that was active through the 90s, and now they're in a few collectives. There's Manoir in Montreal. There's a group, Anarchist Emile Henry, is Quebec City. We've been working closely with a lot of those folks, and, you know, from that, got it together to get a conference, which, you know, great for us. Seattle happened around that time, so it's a, you know, we started probably like spring of 99, and like through a lot of networking, we sort of had like a basic framework and some ideas of where we wanted to go. And then, you know, great, Seattle. So, you know, now we have this whole like anarchist thrust behind us, and no one else is really, you know, organizing much at the time other than participation in more popular groups like Direct Action Network, and which I think is fine and great, and I think people should be organizing there, but I think a lot of message was lost. You know, I saw a lot of anarchist method without, like, the politics sort of being left behind or watered down. And then groups that were, you know, really solid with politics were, you know, like, maybe the Black Bloc, which is a limited strategy in itself. And so, I mean, there's a lot of room between something like Dan and something like the Black Bloc to, you know, have a radical politic and also, you know, open sort of democratic organizing and stuff. So that was sort of the vacuum that we were hoping to fill. And then, you know, we hashed it out over a weekend, some heated bilingual argument, and managed to come together with a collective statement of politics and a structure, and that's pretty much it. We just had our fourth conference recently, and I guess we've doubled our membership at that conference alone, so, you know, we're pretty hopeful. We can talk more about strategy and stuff, which that was a lot of what the conference is about. We spent a lot of time talking about patriarchy and white supremacy and how we see that working into class struggle and how that affects our organizing, and also strategy beyond, you know, kind of summit hopping and more substantive forms of organizing. I mean, that's sort of where we're at now. Just sort of reflected in our magazine as well. We're trying to talk about both theory and strategy, and, you know, how we can move forward as a movement, not just a federation, but how we can actually, you know, play an important part in the larger movement. I guess that's it for history. Stop.
If anyone has any questions, just... Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, yeah.
I just wondered what the name of the group was you mentioned that was anarcho-communist in the 70s and early 80s.
It's the North American Anarchist Communist Federation. And they put out a...
Northeastern.
They put out a paper called the North American Anarchist. And I forgot to change its name to. Maybe Wayne knows.
Okay, I'm going to follow up with some discussion on our vision and our general strategy as a federation. Our vision essentially stems from, as Mark mentioned, the anarchist-communist tradition, and some of what I'm going to say is probably going to overlap with some of what he said, but it's just the way these things go.
It's good because we're late.
Yeah. part of why we chose the anarchist-communist tradition was because what we wanted to do, as opposed to a lot of what we see in terms of the anarchist movement, but both in North America and worldwide, is that there's this broad sense of, I am an anarchist, I believe in anarchism, but there's no real definition of what anarchism is, and even sort of an unwillingness to define terms. And we decided that as people who believe in a certain sort of in the anarchist-communist perspective, we would come together and follow in a long-standing tradition within the anarchist movement, and one that, you know, we tend to think sort of offers the best analysis, in our opinion, of course, of the social situation, the political situation, and economic situation. And it's one of those things where sometimes, you know, you end up in conflict with other sections of the anarchist movement because, you know, we are anarchist communists and we're somehow sectarian or, you know, on the left and oriented towards this authoritarian communist model. But the way we see it is that anarchist communism is something that can work in solidarity with other tendencies in anarchism, tendencies towards looking ecological focus, or a focus that challenges patriarchy, or a focus that challenges racism, or or basically any focus that challenges oppression. It's just that our analysis of those issues stems more or less from a class-based analysis, whereas other tendencies may have a slightly different orientation in how they analyze social structures and systems of oppression. More or less to that end, as a federation, we've developed a set of aims and principles, and I think we have a copy, or there is a copy in the library if anyone's interested in looking at it. We saw it yesterday. That basically addresses sort of each kind of symptom of class society that we came up with through various conferences. And again, it's all sort of oriented from a class perspective and through sort of the lens of an anarchist communist perspective. And at the last conference, there was a lot of discussion, as Mark mentioned, about the role of patriarchy and the role of racism, both within society and within our own movement. So we're starting, in terms of both vision and strategy, kind of move away from the idea of a laundry list of types of oppression into a more systematic analysis. So, because there's also been a lot of internal critique of our aims and principles, you know, you go through and ecology, racism, sexism, homophobia, and then we forgot, you know, things like ableism, and we forget, you know, whatever other forms of oppression we may have forgotten for because either we internalized some things or we simply just didn't have the time to have a bilingual discussion on every form of oppression there is. So we're kind of moving away from that into something where we can sort of say class society creates an oppressive system by which, you know, various forms of oppression, and again, I'm not going to go through that list, are sort of placed upon individuals, and they're used to divide us and to keep us all suppressed and to maintain the power structure and the economic power of the ruling elite. Sort of a basic overview of our way of looking at things. Part of our strategy is, again, as Mark mentioned, you know, the Federation started right about at the same time as a lot of the sort of anti-globalization, if you want to call it that, movement started. And so we've been more or less, because of the fact that these sort of summits come around every 6 months and so do our conferences, we end up being focused towards this summit hopping kind of thing that it seems a lot of the movement is oriented towards. And we as a Federation are trying to move away from that because the whole idea of going from one giant meeting to another and protesting is a very limited strategy in terms of creating social change because, you know, it's something that you focus on as a specific event, whereas we see class struggle as a daily thing, as something that people are engaged in constantly and not something that happens every 6 months when there's a big summit. So what we're doing in terms of both the Federation and as individual collectives is we're trying to focus more or less on dual power. And just to give you like a really boring dictionary style definition of dual power, dual power is a strategy by which a revolutionary movement aims to build social organizational alternatives while simultaneously resisting or destroying capitalism, the state, and patriarchy. So it's the idea of intervening in sort of existing class struggles with the notion that your intervention is one that's going to start to create anarchist alternatives to the existing structure. And member collectives in our Federation have engaged in those sorts of activities on a local level. The Roundhouse Collective in Baltimore worked closely with a strike of laundry workers who work in commercial laundry facilities who were mostly women and people of color, and they were trying to unionize, and basically they weren't getting much support until the people in Roundhouse sort of came to them and helped them make their struggle public, and thus sort of projected both a radical perspective on their struggle and at the same time managed to build solidarity with working people in their community. We've also in Boston, we're sort of looking at issues of organizing housing. There's a few strikes going on in the area and other class-oriented struggles going on that we're starting to sort of intervene on as part of our focus. And a lot, and as a Federation, we're sort of starting to come up with these broad ideas of how to intervene in more direct struggles instead of having to go from, you know, one summit to another, having to sort of attack the large scale structure and at the same time not building infrastructure. It's very important, at least we believe it's very important, that we build some sort of anarchist infrastructure, because otherwise we're really not, we're sort of spinning our wheels. All we're doing is talking a lot of theory and not putting much into practice. There's sort of this push and encouragement of individual members and everyone to get involved in that, and again, be self-critical about the way that we're being, that we get involved in these struggles. You know, I'm going to reference the up-to-date the laundry workers' intervention from the Baltimore Collective. They didn't come into it as, we are the anarchists and we know what you should do. They, of course, came in and said, we're here to help you. We're here and we have our distinct vision, but we're here to help you with your struggle. We're not here to guide you, which is very important, especially in terms of coming in as outsiders into struggles that we're not directly involved with to begin with. We can't take a vanguardist or a leading position in something like that. What we need to do is become, you know, essentially help people with class struggle, with class issues, and not be people who come in and dictate how the class struggle or how the class issue is done and how people work through it. Again, I just want to stress that from the last conference, and this is related back to our vision, we're also starting to come up with a critical perspective on the role of privilege, especially in terms of patriarchy and racial privilege in our federation and in the struggles that we work on. There's been sort of a debate about how the strategy of summit hopping may be something that sort of exists in the world of white male activism. And when you look at, like, the struggles that go on with people who are working class or people who are sort of semi-lumping in their position, people who are working poor, and you look at the class and racial makeup, you see a lot of women and people of color in those positions, and we have to be critical of the way that we approach class struggle, because currently our organization is mostly white men, and we're taking steps back and analyzing our role and, you know, how we organize ourselves as well to try to figure out a way to, I guess, try to figure out how we can sort of change that dynamic within our federation. It's pretty much a quick overview of a vision and strategy.
Wayne?
Well, given the lateness, I'm going to try to make this as quick as I can. Talking about the history of Love and Rage, the last attempt to build a continental anarchist federation, starting about 12 years ago, I'm not sure the exact date, and lasting for about 9 years. What we tried to do that was different at the time, what we were tapped for within the anarchist milieu, was for buildings both. We were pro-organization, we saw the need to build an organization, and we were rather viciously attacked by Fifth Estate and others, including John Beckin, as we had to be a vanguardist authoritarian group, sheerly for trying to form an organization, or at least an organization above the local level. Plus the fact that one of the tendencies that helped form this was the group that I came out of, the Revolutionary Socialist League, which went from Trotskyist to soft Trotskyist, so to speak, to dissolved into anarchism. In fact, we dissolved at the founding conference of Love and Rage. We had to be a vanguardist organization taking over. And they said we were denounced for that. Secondly, we were denounced for being leftist. We were told that being pro-black liberation, pro-working class interests, almost everything except perhaps ecology was, well, that's all the old left. That's we're not interested in that stuff. That's over with. You know, as though blacks and women and working people, they've all had their interests settled and solved by capitalist society. So we were denounced for that. So on the basis of those two issues, the two approaches, so to speak, we formed those people who agreed with us. We tried to get together. We wrote a program which was really sort of a laundry list, as we say, a list of the issue, you know, the key issues of oppression in the society without any particular connection. We tried to write a fuller program. It took us about 9 years, and then we dissolved. This is part of the problem when you form a group with very little theoretical connection beyond those basic issues that we wanted to be in favor of national liberation, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, compared to NEFAC, we couldn't even get an agreement that we were socialist, although everybody agreed they were anti-capitalist. What the word socialist meant, let alone communist, was another issue. We tried to form a central organization. We tried to form it was supposed to be a federation of locals. We didn't use the affinity group model. We tried to use locals. And the problem was that perhaps because it was trying to form it on a continental level, it was very difficult to form locals throughout the country. Individuals joined throughout the country, both by themselves or perhaps in very small groups. It wasn't that we wanted locals throughout the continent, but that's what we got. We were pleased that we had some people in Canada, particularly Hamilton, Ontario. We were in contact with individuals in Quebec, and we had a group in Amor y Rabia in Mexico. But we seem to make this quickly. The problem that the reef in which we broke had to do partly with the heterogeneity of the program and of the individuals. What we hadn't realized at the time is that while my group was moving from Marxism to anarchism, there were other people in the group were moving from anarchism to Marxism, to Maoism. And we sort of met in the middle, and we thought we agreed with each other. But the dynamic, if I can say so, the dialectic of the directions were in different directions. And a large part of that was because the external society, what was going on in the external society? We broke up over this issue, with most people just being throwing up their hands at the whole question. A lot of it was what was going on. This was a few years before Seattle, and there had been a long lull in the struggle. And we can see the secular forces, not only did Love and Rage dissolve, but at the same time that the Quebec anarchist group broke up, the same time our comrades in Mexico broke up, the same time as class war in Britain, which had no connection with us, broke up. So you can see there was a broad tendency that was going on throughout the world, a lull. And when things are really in a lull, you can have the most brilliant program in the world, which we didn't. and things won't go well. On the other hand, when you're in upswing, you can have the most foolish program, which we don't, and you'll start to do well. So it's a good thing that we're in the upswing now. There will be, and we will do our best to ride this forward while producing the best program that we can. That's all.
Thanks, Wayne. So that's kind of a basic overview of a couple different general models, strategies, and pros, cons about federations. If you guys have any questions, we'd love to answer them. Maybe some things to think about, like how or if a federation model could work for collectives that you're in, why you may or may not think that would be okay.